Welcome to the Undraped Artist Podcast. You should know that this episode was also recorded in video and can be watched on our website at theundrapedartist.com and also on YouTube at the Undraped Artist Podcast. Also, check out our show notes to learn more about today's guest. I hope you enjoy the show.
Feeling any better?
Dude, I had a kidney stone again last night. It's my fifth one in 2 months.
What?
Yeah. No, I get them every month, but 5 in 2 months is like a record for me. And last night's was so painful. Wow. I was throwing up and everything. I don't know if it's still there. I think it's probably still there, but it's moved.
Oh, my word.
It's moved somewhere where I got some relief, you know? But
yeah. That's
anyway,
horrible.
So that's why I was late this morning. And then on top of that, my cold. But
yeah, well, yeah, it's fine. You don't need to you don't need to justify it to me. I've had kidney stones, so
it's brutal. Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on, man. It's good to see you.
Yeah.
So I gotta tell everybody, we are cousins, which is awesome. And your dad is my mom's brother. So yeah, so a lot of people don't know that because their last names are different. My mom's maiden name is Pugh, so it's kind of fun. And so how do you feel about this? I gotta tell you a story before I ask you how you feel about it. So when we both placed in that contest, you know, in the Porch Society of America contest, the top 20, right? And my mom, she messaged me or called me, I can't remember, and she goes, Jeff, how do you feel about Mark also placing? I was like, it's great. She says, really? I was like, yeah, why wouldn't it be? She goes, I don't know. You guys are going to be competing against each other. I was like, so it's not a big deal. It was funny. She was so concerned about it. Like we were going to end up in a brawl at the banquet or something.
Yeah, I am not a competitive person like at all. So I don't really.
Really?
Not at all. Yeah.
I'm not about these sort of things.
Yeah, these, I mean, just anything. I'm very concerned. I'm a perfectionist and I'm always very concerned about doing the best that I possibly can with anything. So often people get very competitive with me. Like if I'm playing, you know, a card game or a board game or something, it's not that I'm trying to win or beat anyone. I'm always just trying to do the very best that I possibly can. And I'm very concerned about, just achieving the most I can. And so, but as far as like actually competing with people, like not at all. Yeah. Like almost zero.
So you're really just competing with yourself.
Kind of. Yeah.
That's interesting. Sense. Yeah. And I'm trying to think back to what was that game we used to play all the time when I used to come to your house for Thanksgiving? Cranium?
Oh,
Cranium.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And I'm trying to imagine how you were at that game. I just remember you were really good at the music stuff. Like you could remember any songs, any tunes. And I was completely incompetent in that area.
Yeah.
good times. That was a long time ago, man. That was like 20 years ago was the last time I came over Thanksgiving.
Yeah, really. It's been a while.
It has been a while. That's crazy.
Yeah.
And so are you looking forward to the Porch Society?
Sure. Yeah, of course. It's enjoyable. It's fun. I like going. I like seeing people. Yeah,
it's going to be cool. All right. So this is going to be interesting because I know so much about you. But you're going to have to be speak to me as though we're strangers.
And sure.
As I ask you these questions I want you to speak to me obviously, but imagine I don't know you as well as I do. And because I know the audience wants to know you better. So let's start with your life. Tell me a little bit about how you got, you know, what you were like as a child, how you got interested in art, and how you ended up in the, on this path?
Well, my parents were both artists, or at least inclined to art. They weren't professional artists, but they met in art classes at school, college. And so art was just, it was just a thing, you know. I didn't even question it. It was such a significant part of our home.
So your mom was too? Your mom was into art too?
Yeah.
Dude, I didn't
she did a lot of ink and watercolor stuff. In fact, that's a lot of where sort of my style comes from. With that look, that illustrated look, the ink, the watercolor, that a lot of that comes from my mom. My dad was, you know, very, very talented. And I believe easily could have been a professional artist if he'd, you know, if he'd sought that path. And so, yeah, it was just something we did. Me and my three brothers all just spent a lot of time drawing. You know, I remember at the table, we'd just sit there and we'd draw and we'd look at each other's drawings. Of course, we were all the most enamored with my dad's drawings. were always so amazing. And yeah, it was something I just grew up always wanting to do. And then when I hit college, I got cold feet. I decided to explore other types of things. I got my degree in psychology, and then you know, I saw what you were doing, that you could make it as a successful artist. And so, you know, that inspired me at least to pursue, see what I could do. And, you know, yeah, so I just went from there.
Yeah. So then we had that school, the Bridge Academy, mm-hmm. back in 2008, and you signed up for that. Yeah. How long were you in that? Just a few months or something, maybe, right?
No, I think it was longer than that. I want to say it was probably, it was over a year.
Was it really?
Yeah, for sure. Because my oldest son was born in 2009, and he was while he was a baby, I was still attending there at the Bridge.
Okay.
And teaching, you know, I think I'd moved up. You guys had promoted me to some assistant teaching, or maybe I had my own class or something like that. It's been a while.
It's kind of all blur now. Yeah. And then what happened after you left the Bridge Academy? You kind of just went off on your own, right?
After I left the Bridge Academy, you know, of course, I said that I had my son, and I think I taught a class at your school in Salt Lake.
Oh, that's right.
Like a weekly class.
Yeah, I forgot about that too. Man, dude.
Yeah, for a little while I did that, and then we moved to Texas, and I was working remotely, and the whole time I was sort of working on building up a portfolio, and really just exploring kind of my own style. It wasn't, I didn't quite feel like I was yet ready to kind of put my work out there, put myself out there. I was trying to find my own kind of look and style, but I was selling here and there. I had a gallery or two that were showing my work, but I wasn't selling much, you know, a very, very little bit. It kind of kept me going. And then with the recession and the job I was working for.
The recession in 2008?
Yeah.
Okay.
So even though this was a little bit after that, but still some repercussions.
Oh, right.
And my job, it was just this very small company, only two or three employees, was just getting smaller and smaller. And finally they let me go in very end of 2012. And I decided, you know, I had a little bit of a body of work there. That's when I reached out to some galleries. You know, we weren't far from Santa Fe. Got picked up by a couple, and like I said, selling work a little bit here and there. We moved back to Utah. I got a job, still doing all of that. And then I want to say 2016, I just said, I can't do this. I've got to go full time or not at all, because, you know, it wasn't going to happen. Mm-hmm. By just kind of working a little bit, you know, a couple hours a week, part, you know, on the side kind of thing. So I quit my job. You know, Susan, my wife, was pregnant with our fifth child, our youngest daughter, and, you know, essentially had a panic attack when I suggested, hey, I want to quit my job and be an artist, especially because I wasn't consistently making money, but we did have a little bit of a savings. I said, let me try this out until our savings runs out and then I can find another job. And I, fortunately, that never had to happen. I was able to, you know,
I didn't know
sales
that.
Picked up a little. And, yeah,
man, you did that with five kids or four and a half, I guess.
Yeah, four and a half. Yeah.
Holy moly. That's scary.
It was terrifying. And it was hard. It was extremely hard. And there was a long period of time where, you know, we were just, you know, flying by the seat of our pants, you know, trying to find a way to make it work. Susan got a degree and started teaching 2019. So 3 years later, after I quit, she started working as a school teacher. So that eased it up a little bit. But by then, my career was picking up a little bit too. And, you know, so I got a little late into it in the game. You know, I know you were like really young. Early 20s.
No, I was pretty late too, but I mean, not compared to you. I didn't get rolling until 28. But that was just because, you know, of all the medical issues and stuff back then.
Yeah.
So I got a little bit of a late start. I didn't finish University of Utah until I was 28.
Yeah. I was late 30s.
Yeah.
Yeah. A little bit older before I kind of hit my stride.
But I didn't realize it was, it's been 8 years. That's insane. I didn't realize you've been at it for 8 years.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
When did you feel like you had your look? Cause that's one of the things about you that I think a lot of people appreciate. I certainly do, is that you have a very unique look. And how did you, I don't want to say how did you come about it, because my assumption is that it sort of happened organically, but like, tell me a little bit about that process though.
You know, yes and no. It happened organically in spite of my best efforts to fight against it.
Well, what do you mean?
Well, so essentially what happened, you know, I guess a footnote in clarifying, even though we are related and we've known each other a long time, and I've gone to two of the schools that you've taught at, how much you've kind of played a part. You helped me develop, I think, my skills and my techniques.
Right.
But as far as like actual career stuff,
yeah, you've been on your own.
Almost none. Like, yeah. Virtually none. And so, you know, I don't want to people to think that, you know, you were kind of behind the scenes pushing things to make
no
things
like
happen.
I'm learning all this stuff almost, right now.
It virtually did not happen
right
at all. But you know, you taught me techniques and skills, and you know, through developing those, essentially my journey as an artist prior to any sort of traditional technique skills that I learned from you was about drawing things out of my head, you know, all kinds of imagination stuff. You know, I was into, growing up, I was into fantasy, I was into comic book art, a lot of illustrative stuff. You know, that sort of classical realism was not even, you know, I didn't think much about that at all. And then you saw, you know, you encouraged me to kind of pursue some stuff. You taught me some skills, and I kind of abandoned a lot of that imaginative stuff that I grew up doing, and just really sort of focused on just kind of that classical realism look. And you know, all
do you have any of that older work? I remember that work.
That's pretty much all I have. Yeah, that's pretty much all I have. Most everything else that I do sells pretty quickly.
No. I mean, do you still have it on your Instagram and stuff?
Probably.
Yeah, you do.
Probably.
Here's one. Here, I'm going to pull it up real quick.
Yeah, sure.
So, like, this one is one I remember.
Yeah. That's a very old one. So, That's my wife.
Just your youngest daughter?
My oldest daughter.
Oh, okay.
So, that's a pretty old one. Yeah, but, you know, I still kind of... I've always been about storytelling, has always been important to me. But I wasn't really selling anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it was hard because, you know, having a family like I did, you know, if you want to keep going, you have to at least make some money. I get a commission here and there that would help, but I really was not selling much. And to be perfectly honest, while I'm proud of the work that I did, I wasn't really connected to it,
right?
Personally, and so I had an experience where. I had a conversation with somebody, a professional in the business who was trying to help me, give me some advice about what I could do to make my work more sellable, and was giving me ideas and suggestions and try this or do that. Okay, you know, and I think that this individual was, you know, had good intentions, you know, wanted the best for me. And I did a painting that was, I kind of took all of this information that they gave me, all of their suggestions. I made this painting, and this was a gallery, someone from a gallery, and I sent the image to the gallery, and the gallery's like, we don't want that painting.
So they directed and rejected it.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. And I, you know, I don't blame them. Although I like the painting, it's not a bad painting. It's one I don't even think I've ever photographed it. Aside from like just a quick shot to show the gallery.
Was this a Park City gallery?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, this is not a Park City gallery. And so I was like, it was not a fun experience. Mm. My heart was in it. I had no connection to this painting. And I was like, why am I why am I basing what I paint or what I do around the around what I think other people want? And it was kind of at this point, this was after 2016. So I had already quit my job to do this full time. I was struggling, you know, just trying to find some way to support my family. And I was like, you know what, this is it. I was sort of at a point, a low point, where it was like, if I don't make this happen, I have to, you know, I have to kind of abandon this, get a job doing, you know, who knows what else, maybe go back to school or something. And so I was like, I just want to paint what I want to paint. Even if it doesn't sell, I don't care. And then there was this. So I started kind of doing my own thing. And I was like, you know, I got into like a little bit more of like a surreal narrative kind of look. But it was still all really focused on realism. And because of my setup, my situation, you know, a lot of my figures are, they're in a, like a landscape setting, an outdoor setting. And so I was doing all of these sort of paintings from my imagination, but were meant to look like real locations.
Okay.
And so I want to say that around 2000, maybe 18, 19, somewhere around there, I was in a smaller show with a gallery in Santa Fe, like a group show. And I had, you know, a handful of paintings there. And I went down to the show, to the opening, and I was talking to the gallery director, and she was asking me questions about a painting I had there that was getting a good response. People really enjoyed it. And I remember making a comment to her, explaining my work, and almost apologetically telling her that, you know, oh yeah, this painting here, the background, you could probably tell, but I did it from imagination. And I had this moment of clarity right then. And I'm like, if I'm working from imagination anyway, you know, why don't I embrace that? I didn't feel like painting landscapes from imagination. I didn't feel bad. I felt like I was decent at it, but I didn't feel like it was a real strength for me. And I'm like, why don't I embrace this? Why am I playing around with, you know, why am I fighting against my tendencies? I've got to embrace my strengths. Not only that, I think embrace my weaknesses, you know, because I don't think I'm the most talented artist out there. I see other people's work, just blows me away. I'm like, I could, maybe eventually I could do something like this with enough work and enough time, but it's not where my strength is. And so for me, it was all about honing in on my strengths and my weaknesses and saying, not only is this, you know, the best type of painting I could create, but it's also the kind of painting I want to create. And so for me, you know, my experiences with these two galleries, it was like, it was a moment where, and I hope this stays true throughout my career, I was like, I don't ever want to paint for anyone but myself. I want all these paintings to be paintings that, you know, I would be willing to hang up in a room, in my studio, even if nobody ever saw this painting but me, you know, a painting that I love, that I want to look at, that, you know, that just really, really connects with me personally. And so I, you know, that's kind of my approach, is I only paint for me. And once I did that, especially once I said, you know, I'm just going to do paintings where the background is all from imagination, clearly from imagination, in that illustrated style that I grew up loving, that is really just really connects with me. Once I did that, that's when my, you know, my career took off. And so the best thing that the best decision I made was to stop caring what anybody else thought about my work.
That's certainly a good lesson for any artist, I would think. I mean, I've had a similar experience. I mean, mildly similar, but, I remember when I was in school, everyone was telling me, don't paint the thing that I wanted to paint. And they're like, it'll never sell. And I kept saying to them, I don't want to paint anything else. And and everyone would say, don't paint it. And you remember that old work with those big figures and the abstract backgrounds and stuff? People are like, no one's going to hang a stranger in their house. No one's going to do it. Everyone said that. But I had to do it because I wasn't interested in anything else at the time. And I had the same experience where that was the thing that resonated with people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it's a good career lesson.
I think so. And the way that I look at it is, you know, if I really love this, it's virtually impossible that look, that style, that thing that resonates with me, almost certainly going to resonate with other people. Not everybody, but other people. There will be other people. But if I'm painting something that I don't care about, that doesn't mean anything to me, there is a very real chance that would not resonate with anybody. That there's nobody on earth that would care about that. So, you know, it doesn't make sense to me why I would paint anything else other than what I just feel so strongly about.
But isn't it the case, though, it's not because you're the judge and jury of what is quality and what is interesting. It's because if you aren't into it, you're not going to put your best foot forward.
Yeah.
Right? It's like if you're interested in hockey, but you're forced to play backgammon every day, like you're just not going to get into it, and you're not going to be you're not going to be your best. You're going to be wanting to play a different sport.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. It has nothing to do with me deciding that this is what other people would like. It's that I have this drive and this desire, you know, it's hard to explain. Just this yearning for a look, a style, just the way, you know, just the way something feels to me. And you know, you mentioned that, you know, I was into music, and you know, and before I lost, and even still, I still listen to a lot of music. It's not the same since I lost my hearing, but I can't write music like I used to. It's a lot harder. And so a lot of the time when I compose a painting, and I use that word deliberately, I compose it the way that I would compose a piece of music. I want it to resonate with me just on an emotional level. I want it to sing. I want it to have a voice. I want to hear it. I want to be able to pick out a specific song that I can listen to that sounds like the way I want a certain painting to sound. So that kind of emotional quality is extremely important to me in my work, not because I am, not because it's sort of calculated, but because that's how it was born. It was born through that sort of sound, that voice. Mm-hmm. And I try to make that true for all of my paintings. You know, some I think a little bit more connected than others.
Hmm. Yeah. Can you expound more on that? I'm curious. I mean, I'm not a musician, as you know, so it's like, mm-hmm. it's hard for me to really truly understand the metaphor, but I've often thought, mm-hmm. And I'm curious what your opinion is on this. I've often been a little envious of musicians because there's something about music that can evoke emotion in a way that a painting often can't. Paintings can, but but sometimes I think music has the edge a little bit. So I'm curious if you feel that way, one, and two, because it's a perfect metaphor because of that, in my opinion. It's like if you can make your painting, quote, sing, you know, it suggests that it's got something more than just visual stimulation, but it's emotional.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, I graduating in psychology, so I have at least some rudimentary kind of education about some of this is, you know, music affects our brains in a certain way. It's almost more than almost anything else, it can just tap into sort of those emotional centers of our brain. And so, you know, when people look at my paintings, do they get that response that I do, that where it's just kind of hitting them on that same emotional level that music is? I don't know. I have no idea what other people's experiences are. Again, I'm painting for myself, mm-hmm. and for what it does for me. But I think there can be something when, you know, when we have a visual aspect and an auditory aspect, of stimulation from both. You know, and I think about like film, movies, doing this where you've got the visual component and you've got the auditory component, and they kind of harmonize and they make both of those, you know, if they are separate parts of the brain, just kind of they echo with each other and they amplify one another. And so, you know, I do think music can on its own stimulate more than just an image can on its own, typically, although, you know, pieces of music that don't resonate at all, and then some images that very strongly do. But I think when they're together, there is a lot of that. And so a lot of my working process, you know, if I'm painting a figure from reference, I'll listen to podcasts or audiobooks or, you know, something like that, because I don't feel like I'm using the same parts of my brain. But when I'm going through that creative part where I'm trying to figure out the story I'm trying to tell, or the way that I want a background illustration to look, I will always listen to music. Hmm. And I'll pick music that, you know, has that emotional tone that I'm looking for. Not because I'm trying to paint that, but because that triggers those parts of my brain that open up that creative element that I'm looking for, that allow me to kind of, tap into that just that creative energy that I need to really find what I want a certain painting to do, or the story I want that painting to tell. Mm-hmm. So it's extremely helpful for me. And I use music, you know, music is a very, very important tool to my work.
Hmm. All right, let's look at it. Let's look at some of your work then. This is a good segue. Where is the best place to see your work? Would it be Instagram or your website?
I mean, you're going to find stuff on Ball. I might go to my website. That's a new painting.
Yeah, this is the one that placed in the top 20 at the Portrait Society of America.
Right. Conference. Yeah, it did. And that's part of a, my upcoming show, next month, my one man show with Arcadia.
That's next month.
It's a large painting. Yeah. Yeah.
Really?
It's
in New York.
Yeah. In fact, New York. Yeah. The opening is, the Thursday before the portrait show. So they're going to pack that up and ship it the day after the opening to be part of the conference.
Wow.
In Georgia.
Wow.
Yeah. So as far as this painting, this is one. So to give an example about sort of that creative process for creating this one, I had the basic idea. My middle child, this one here is my third child, right smack in the middle, Elsie, and she's basically me.
Really?
But a young female version of me. I mean, she got my genes, you know, big time. She constantly creates, she draws, she writes stories, she plays, you know, she writes music. She's, you know, she choreographs her own dances. I mean, she's just constantly creating, you know, and so I had the idea to do a painting of her drawing. And so really, you know, the basic idea came, you know, I work from photos out of, you know, there's no way for me to get any of my children to sit for long enough for me to paint.
Yeah, it's
them.
Tough.
So, you know, I posed her just in that little pose with her drawing. Little sketchbook. And then once I had that, it was, you know, then I had to decide how I wanted to tell that story of her drawing. And so that's when, you know, I would listen to music and try and get into that sort of that emotional place I wanted to be, to compose all of the imaginative elements, the parts from imagination. And so, you know, I thought about putting her, I what did I want her to draw? And I thought, I just, you know, something just small, something very small, where she's focusing on something, you know, but what to do about everything else. So I thought I'll do a bird. I often do birds. And you know, but I didn't know how I wanted to compose the rest of the painting. And so that's kind of where that sort of emotional element came from. I have a tendency, I like things that are sort of a little macabre. I mean, I like things in life that are very macabre. You know, I like horror. I like very gruesome, gnarly, ugly stuff. But I don't put that in my art. But I want there to be just, you know, just a little dash of that in a lot of my paintings. That just kind of like, you know, I want my paintings. I love the juxtaposition of having something that is very, you know, I paint children a lot, partly because I have a lot of children and they're, you know, easily accessible models, but they're also great for telling stories. Mm-hmm. I've found, you know, but I want to avoid, I always try very hard to avoid painting children in this sort of like light, you know,
just sappy.
Yeah, this way that I think a lot of adults see, they put children on a pedestal. Mm-hmm. They're, you know, the innocence, and of course children are innocent. Yeah, you know, I'm not gonna say that, whatever, and disclaimer there,
right?
But you know, I don't want to idealize children in that sense. I want to ground them. I want to, you know, kids go through very hard things and dark things and difficult things, and they experience very real emotions and hard emotions and sadness, depression, and things like that. And while I'm not trying to make all of my kids look sad and depressed, although I have been accused of that before, it's not really what I'm going for. I'm going for, I'm trying to tell as much of a story as I can in as blank a slate as possible, so that viewers can kind of pull out from my paintings what they want to pull out. And I like it to, in order to avoid kind of that sappiness, I like to kind of put those, just a touch of those darker elements in there. You know, and so that bleak background, the iron gate there, just this kind of like, you know, you've got this girl painting a nice bright orange bird, but you know, I wanted it I wanted there to be like that stark sort of quality, but also at the same time, I have to make sure that that those backgrounds don't distract or detract from the figure, from the main subject. And so that is something as well, compositionally, that I find myself just really having to work out a lot while I compose my paintings.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing you're really good at is making these illustrative backgrounds, as you put it, work with your classical figures. Cause it would be, I would think it would be difficult to unify those things because they're so different from one another. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So is that, you find that that's a little bit of a challenge to make sure that they work together and they don't sort of feel like completely separate, completely foreign to one another.
Yeah, for sure. That is something that I very much have to work out, to focus on, to be careful of. Mm-hmm. And the way I've found to do that the best is if I simplify as much as possible both of those elements, so that, you know, if I overly complicate either one, then I worry, you know, and maybe I've done this before, you know, I don't know. I always try to avoid it, but overly complicating either one so that I don't want them to muddle one another. I want them to kind of just work in balance. There has to be a balance there. And it is something I very deliberately focus on and work on with my compositions.
Hmm. So is the background entirely graphite?
Not entirely. So the process for that, and I've done different things to get different looks. You know, I have used graphite, I've used ink just directly on my canvases. That is graphite, but the top there in the sky, and then where the bricks are, is actually an oil-based wash to appear like graphite.
Really?
So, yeah. So the intention is to make it, and I think even in the fence, there's in the fence, like just a wash of very, very diluted oil. And then I go with graphite over top that lightly to hopefully give it the look that the whole thing is a graphite drawing. But in all my paintings, whether it looks like it or not, there is oil over 100% of my paintings to some degree, either a wash or often I'll do like, you know, if there's white in my painting, it's not, you're not saying canvas that I painted the white there. So it's
right,
not,
right.
I don't ever have just bare canvas in any of my paintings.
Hmm. Yeah, that is gorgeous. You know, one thing I was thinking about is you mentioned how children are so difficult to paint because they're not going to hold still for you. And I get mm-hmm. that because I had similar issues with my kids, but it's interesting that in the painting, she's painting this tiny little bird. It's as though she's your little bird, this little,
yeah,
you know what I mean? This, this little being that is just going to fly away any minute. So you have to capture her quick. And then that's you know, what the narrative is, where she's doing something, painting this little being that is just going to dart away any second.
I love that. You know, I'll be honest. I didn't think of that element, but that makes a lot of sense. I did think it was intentional to have, you know, she's drawing and I'm drawing
mm-hmm.
the background, and the drawing is turning into a bird and she's turning that bird back into a drawing. That circular element was deliberate for this particular piece. I like that added layer that you give it, where I essentially, she's drawing that bird, and to me, she is that. Mm-hmm. Likewise,
yeah, that chair really stood out to me. I don't know why. I love the chipped paint and everything, man. It's so beautifully painted.
Thank you.
And that sleeve, holy moly! I wish I could zoom in on it, but I can't on my computer.
That's gorgeous. that was a lot of work, and a technique that I have never used before or since on that sleeve, where I painted I rendered everything out. I painted her flesh just as I would on her arm, leaving space where all the little, details, fabric details were. And then I kind of painted over top of that and let the flesh come through.
Oh, you did.
Under transparent paint. It was a process I've never used before. I thought it worked well. I'll probably use it again at some point.
I just take a minute to recognize the people and companies that make this podcast possible. First, I want to thank you, my patrons. You are absolutely the most important and necessary sponsors of this podcast. Without you, we couldn't keep this thing going. If you love the show and are not yet a patron, please consider helping out. Go to theundrapedartist.com and click on the link Be My Patron on Podbean. And then just pick a monthly amount that fits your budget. What are 4 great podcasts a month worth to you? In my opinion, my sponsor Rosemary Brushes makes the best artist brushes available today. They have a huge inventory and are constantly innovating and adding new and interesting brushes to their line. They ship all over the world, and due to their exceptional customer service, you won't wait long to receive your order. To order some brushes for yourself, go to rosemaryandco.com. The Hein Atelier began over 20 years ago in 2002. Due to limited space and high demand, in 2022, I adapted the entire curriculum to an online platform. While on our website and mobile app, students will find hundreds of hours of valuable recorded content, this online atelier is not just a website full of lessons, tutorials, and other resources. In this program, I personally mentor each student toward their artistic goals through weekly Zoom critiques, instruction, and regular in-app communications. To learn more or to sign up, go to heinatelier.com. Lastly, whether you're watching or listening on Apple Podcasts or just listening on another station like Spotify, please consider leaving me a 5-star review. If you watch on YouTube, consider giving me a follow and a thumbs up. These things really help the channel.
All right, so let's look at some more of your work here. So now we're on your website.
Yeah.
Is the best way just to flip through, or can you see thumbnails? I guess you just kind of have to flip through, huh?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, I don't know.
It's your website.
I need it.
I know. We're all neglecting our websites. This is one of my favorite paintings of yours. First of all of these your kids? Is everything, every person you paint, a child of yours?
No, not all of them. That's not my child.
Yeah, you can tell. You have a look.
She is. Yeah, most of them are. I mean, again, when you live with four little perfect models need. In fact, talking to my wife, I'm like, I have got to take just like tons and tons and tons of photos of them.
They're
going to
grow up.
Right. And unfortunately I just keep neglecting to do that. Eventually they're not going to be as useful to me as they are now.
Man. Yeah. You're sitting on a gold mine right now with these three or four. Yeah. You have four girls and one boy, right?
Right. My oldest is a boy, and then four girls, and that's my second to youngest, Maggie. And she is, so that one won the grand prize with the ARC, salon.
The grand prize. Congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. So I was in New York, last summer,
That's right. I saw some of your posts. I didn't realize it was the grand prize. Wow.
Yeah. So my daughter Maggie is, I mean, she's a comedian. She loves making people laugh. She likes being silly. And it was unbelievably difficult to photograph her.
Really?
I use some of my daughters more than others just simply because, not because of their look, but because they're easier to work with. They just, you know, they're better at holding still. They're better at, you know, listening to instructions or whatever. Maggie was very difficult because she kept just trying to make me laugh because I was taking photos and she kept wanting to look at the photos afterwards. So she kept doing funny things, making funny faces.
Oh God!
You know, quickly running out of the screen just before I would take the picture. She thought it was so funny. I kid you not, for this one I probably took close to 200 photos.
No way.
It was a lot. That might be over exaggerating, but it certainly felt like 200 photos. And so, I mean, it was, most of those photos were her kind of smiling or making a silly face. And I think this one, eventually I had to just kind of distract her enough so she wasn't aware that I was taking the photos. You know,
how
and
old
I kept
is
trying
she?
Different things. At the time, I want to say she would have been...
Oh, so she's really young. Yeah.
Yeah, dude. Maybe even five or six. And she was really tough, but she kept saying that I was painting her older sisters. I was like, when are you gonna paint me? And so I, okay, well, let's do it, you know. I had nothing in mind, no ideas. And that happens sometimes. Sometimes I'll just, you know, I'll put my girl in front of the camera. I'll look at them. I'll tell them to do this or that. And it's not until afterward that I'm able to, you know, I look at the photo and I develop some kind of story. Sometimes I have an idea in mind and I'll pose them specifically for what I want. With her, I mean, I did all kinds of different poses and looks, and had her hold different things. She couldn't figure out what to do with her hands. I'm like, here's a book. Hold this book.
Wow.
Put it behind you. Put it in front of you. And so, you know, I got this photo, and it was the most compelling of all of the images. And, you know, I went through everything, and I'll pick out the few that I like the most. And I felt like the look on her face, the way she was standing, everything was very compelling to me, although I had no story around it. I didn't know what I wanted to do with the background. And so all of this painting was developed, each stage just trying to figure out what to do at each stage of the painting, not knowing beforehand how they were all going to fit.
You're and kidding. So,
huh. Yeah.
And then it becomes an award-winning painting.
Yeah. And the last one that I did with Elsie, most of that I had from the get-go. So posing her, I knew mostly how I wanted it to look, you know, 75-80% of how I wanted it to look. Some paintings I know 100% from the get-go, and then other paintings like this, I went in having no idea what I was going to do. And fortunately, it worked out.
So tell me about how you came to these decisions. Why the sunflowers? Why the torn paper on the floor?
So, you know, the idea is, well, okay, so I took the photo again, just going off of the photo, right, deciding, okay, this is the most compelling image. What is she thinking? What is she doing? Why is she holding this book behind her back? You know, and there, you know, the look that she was giving me, there was, you know, maybe a little bit of, being ashamed in there, but it was more of like this sort of like defiance.
Looks like you just sent her to bed early is what it looks like.
Well, you know, my wife always insists, let me brush their hair out. And I'm like, no, I like the horrible scraggly, you know, uncombed hair.
Mention that, because I wondered if that's what inspired the sunflower petals, because I see a connection between the petals and her hair.
Yes, yes. And so the sunflowers, you know, I like sunflowers. I like the look of sunflowers. I like sunflowers, you know. I mean, sunflowers are a good metaphor for me for how I approach my paintings in the first place, because they're, you know, sunflowers, sunshine, bright yellow, but there's also this kind of like gloominess to sunflowers, especially, you know, once you hit like late summer, early fall, and they kind of start withering and wilting, and there's this kind of, you know, there's this sort of that kind of darker look to them that I really, really like. And so, yes, the sunflowers are essentially mimicking her. It's right. Meant to create
the
this
head down.
This repetitive quality of, you know, at least visually they echo what she's doing. It's this repetitiveness of what she's doing, and you know, it's the story being, you know, there's the little ripped up piece of the paper. She's hiding the book behind her back, but she's also sort of looking directly at the viewer as if, you know, yeah, I know what I did. What are you going to do about it? kind of look to her. You know, the title is An Unsatisfying Ending. So, you know, she didn't like what she read. She tore it up. sort of thing. And yeah, and all of that just came slowly over the whole process of painting. I didn't have a lot of this in mind. It was more of, you know, sometimes like with a painting like this, I'll spend, you know, total time throughout the painting process, hours just sitting back staring at it, trying to work out the composition. What do I want this to be doing? What is happening here? And until it hits me and I feel like, okay, that's what I need to do. This is the right thing. I usually don't do anything. In fact, sometimes I'll get halfway through a painting and I'll set it aside for weeks or sometimes months because I haven't decided how the story finishes. I don't know what happens next. And so until I feel really good about it and happy and satisfied with where it's going, I won't do anything unless there's a deadline and I have to. And then I try and speed up the process and, figure it out quicker. But if I have the time, I like to let it marinate.
Hmm. Does that stress you out to have paintings just sitting and not knowing the solution? Or are you able to kind of let them go and move on to something else for a while?
Again, as long as I don't have a deadline coming up, I think it would stress me out more to continue without knowing the direction I'm going. That would really stress me out. Because I would be constantly second guessing myself, thinking about, just the feeling of being unsatisfied with a painting, I would assume to many artists, most artists, is one of the most stressful, horrible feelings. To just look at a painting and be unsatisfied or unhappy with it. And so that would be worse for me than just sitting and letting it.
Yeah, that's true.
Do for a while.
So tell me about this one. This is dark. Did he just rip a bird to shreds or what?
Well, he's got a knife, so he stabbed it. that was for a group show for Arcadia as well. And that's a smaller painting. And that's my son. And that's a rare case where I'll paint my son. He just is not. He doesn't care. He's not interested.
Yeah, I remember meeting
him
and
being part of my
He's such a teenager. It's just like hey, I'm your dad's cousin. He's like, I don't care.
Basically, that's Howard for sure.
Yeah.
That one. I felt it was like, hey, this is for a group show. It's one painting. I'm gonna embrace a little bit more the macabre. And there is one or two paintings in my upcoming show that I do that a little bit more. I allow a little bit more of that kind of darkness to come in. And specifically the reason I do this, and some keen-eyed artists have even commented on this and may notice, my illustrated backgrounds, while I'm not usually trying to mimic another artist's work, they are influenced sometimes heavily more than others. And this one specifically, not just influenced, I was deliberately trying to invoke Edward Gorey, who I love, and
I don't know who that is.
That's people who are familiar with illustrator from the 70s mostly, is I think when he was big. He's a big name illustrator, and anyone who's familiar with Edward Gorey will instantly recognize his influence on my own work. He does a lot of children. He did children's books, but they were all like not inappropriate for kids. Kids could certainly look at them, but not really for kids. Very dark, kind of very macabre. And so I was like, I want to do my version of kind of an Edward Gorey sort of thing. So a boy killing a bird, and then the background style, very Edward Gorey like. And I've done that more than once to kind of that Edward Gorey look that I really, really love.
Yeah, it is really interesting and really beautiful.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was just going to flip through a few more of these. If any of the... Oh, this is this one an older one? Oh, man, I love this one.
Yeah,
sorry, we can go back and you comment on that. Was that an older one? That seems more like your classical style a little bit more.
You
well,
know,
I guess not. It's just dark.
It's very dark. It's very dark. That is not terribly old. I want to say that one's maybe 3-4 years old.
I don't even remember this one. How did I miss this one? It's really cool.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, that one, again, I'm always, not always, I'm often experimenting. I like to kind of, when I feel like I'm kind of in a sort of a, I don't know, an automatic mode, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. where, yeah, I've got my style, I've got my step. When I'm too comfortable with my process, I like to kind of challenge myself of what I can do different, what I can do new. That there's a little bit of that in this, you know, for starters, she's not a child. A little bit different, but more recent than you might expect.
Yeah, no, the more I look at it, I see all the same elements. It's just that you could easily, if you don't look closely, or at a glance, I should say, this just feels like night. And then when you look, you're like, no, it's more of that illustrative design-oriented background as well. It's just so dark that it falls
a lot of glazing. Yeah. Lots and lots of glazing in there.
Yeah, man, it's really cool. Yeah, this is one of my favorites of yours. Oh, my gosh.
Thank you.
I love this.
So that one, that's interesting. So this is actually a good painting as an example for some of the stuff I was talking about earlier with my experience and my journey as an artist. I actually had done this painting. It's two separate paintings, but combined as one piece.
Yeah.
And I had done this in my old style. This was an older painting, and speaking of being unsatisfied, I was never satisfied with it. I didn't like, I was not happy with it. And then I had that, and I knew I didn't like it, even though I had taken photos and posted it. I think I'd even shown it publicly at some point. I set it aside and, you know, I don't often rework old paintings, but I had it. I was looking at it and I had an idea to change it. And essentially I took a painting that was older. I want to say I even sanded it down to a degree and I completely redid the whole thing.
No way.
Background all completely new. Repainted her. And that's my oldest daughter. So this, when I actually took those photos, she was probably like 5 or 6, somewhere around there. And now she's 12 now. So a few years ago. Yeah, I redid everything in sort of that, what at the time was that newer style. And in fact, so much of this was so experimental. I didn't know how, you know, ink would interact with oil paint. I didn't know how, a lot of this one is all just experimenting and playing around with, you know, I knew kind of the direction I wanted to go, what I wanted my things to look like. I just didn't know how I was going to do it at that time.
No kidding. So you must have made a lot of discoveries on this one then.
Yeah, I think so. And I still do. I'll still, you know, if I have an idea in my mind, I'm always trying to consider how, you know, what can I possibly do to make it work, to implement the idea that I have, how I want it to look. You know, maybe it's something I've done before, but I just want to do it in a different way because I want it to look a little different. I'm always playing around, trying new things.
Oh, another inch, man. Yeah, that one's also What is the word you use? Macabre? I'm not even familiar with that word. What is that in reference to? What does that mean?
Just kind of a little darker, a little, just kind of, you know, horror, like media can be referred to as macabre.
Hmm.
Yeah, just a little darker. Not so much this one.
No, this one's quite light. This, you know, another thing I love about your stuff is that juxtaposition between three-dimensional and two-dimensional. You're casting shadows on the canvas, and I get it almost, I guess you could call it even Trump Loy in a way. And yet not always. Like, so, you know, like the, I suppose, yeah, there's a shadow of the girl too. So she's casting her own shadow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, it's interesting that juxtaposition between two and three dimensions. I like that. Okay. So I don't know how many of the podcasts you've listened to, but I always end with this question.
Okay.
I'm really curious what it would be, because you had such a, you know, kind of a unique road with having your kids and then starting your career so late in the game when you had five kids at home, or four and a half, one in the oven at least. What advice would you give an aspiring artist? Maybe some advice you wish you had, or some advice you did have that really made a difference in your journey to be to this level of success that you're at now.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I guess it shouldn't really be surprising. The advice I have is the one thing I wish I had considered, or the one thing I wish I'd done from the start is just to really create art for myself. Just, you know, to not resist the urges I had to kind of do things that maybe were different, or maybe things, you know, people told me, don't do this, don't do that. It, you know, in learning and developing my skill, you know, when I was at that stage in my own journey, there were so much, you know, going to classes or listening to other artists, you know, giving tutorials. So often you'd hear artists say, don't do this, don't do that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, and I think as a student learning, you just kind of, you not knowing any better, it's like, oh, okay, all right, that, you know, they're successful, they know what they're talking about, so I'm not going to do those things. You know, I say try them. If somebody tells you not to do it, A, figure out why they say you shouldn't do it, because their reason might be something like, oh, I don't care about that. Well, I, you know, that's not important to me. You know, do it, and figure out on your own whether or not, you know, why somebody might say not to do it, whether or not it works for you. Mm-hmm. And your style, your approach, your technique. But ultimately, you know, I remember an artist when this was way back at the Bridge, you guys would have guest artists come weekly, I want to say, or
I can't remember.
Every other week, something like that. We have guest artists. It was a really cool experience. We'd go and listen to them lecture. And, an artist that, I can't remember who it was, an amazing artist, insanely talented artist, so good, stuff just blew me away. And I remember him saying that he wishes he could do something else, not career wise, but art wise, like, you know. I think he was a landscape artist, and he was like, I can't paint people. I wish I could do that. I can't do figures. I would love to get into this. I'd love to do it, but you know, there was such an expectation for him from clients, from galleries, you know, this is what he does. So he essentially was stuck doing something that he just was not really what he wanted to do. And so if you're going to get stuck with a particular style or look or doing something, you've got to have it be something that you love, mm-hmm. that you're passionate about, that you want to keep doing. So that would be my advice. Paint for you, paint for yourself, do what speaks to you. And don't be so caught up with, you know, what other artists are saying, what galleries are saying, what clients are saying of what you should do, what you shouldn't do, because I did that. I listened to that advice and I kid you not, worrying about what other people thought about my art, I believe, postponed any real significant developments in my art for, you know, a decade.
Wow.
You know, because I spent so much time worrying about if I was doing it right. And mm-hmm. being a perfectionist, I always want to do everything the best I can, the right way. And so I was so worried about not doing it right that I just followed all that advice, and it was a problem for me. I said, just do what you want to do, do what you're passionate about, and grow off of that, you know, expand off of that. And that's going to put you in the best place to succeed, both in the quality of your work and I think succeed as in your career.
Yeah. That's great advice. Thanks, Mark. It's been fun having you on the show.
Yeah, for sure, Jeff.
Opportunity. Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Look forward to seeing you in Georgia.
Yeah, it's going to be a blast. All right, see you then.
Thanks for tuning in to the Undraped Artist Podcast. If you enjoyed it, subscribe. And if you could, leave a comment or review. That really helps the channel. Please share the show with your friends. And if you're feeling generous, consider a monthly donation at theundrapedartist.com. Thanks again for watching. We'll see you next week.